LLAM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming family audiences for the folkloric Virsky Ukrainian National Dance Company, and a free Arts for Kids presentation by the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the role local activists and community groups are playing in revitalizing city neighborhoods. Our guest is Alexander von Hoffman. He is a senior research fellow at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard, and he teaches at Harvard's Graduate School of Design. Dr. von Hoffman is the author of House by House, Block by Block, The Rebirth of America's Urban Neighborhoods. The book looks at how local organizations are renewing and rebuilding neighborhoods in five major American cities: Chicago, Atlanta, New York, Boston, and Los Angeles. Von Hoffman says despite the great efforts of these grassroots groups, they do need help from local government, and they need access to capital. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to House by House, Block by Block, Alexander von Hoffman is the author of Fuel Lines for the Urban Revival Engine and Local Attachments, The Making of an American Urban Neighborhood, 1850 to 1920. He has also written for publications such as the Boston Globe and Atlantic Monthly. House by House, Block by Block is published by Oxford University Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to join the discussion. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Look forward to your telephone calls this afternoon. And Alexander von Hoffman joins us this afternoon from Harvard University. Good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Not long ago, the inner city was seen by most of us as a place of desperation. But today, as you note in the introduction to this book, researchers write now of islands of decay in seas of renewal. What sparked this renewed vigor in community development?
Well, it took a little bit of time and a lot of effort and a lot of courage by people at the grassroots. I was thinking before we started about this great change, and I thought, what if you had a social transformation and nobody noticed? One of the problems that we have is once an image gets lodged in our heads, it's really hard to get it out of there. Most of us think of inner city neighborhoods, the old ghetto neighborhoods, places like that, even sometimes in small cities, as the places we hear about on the 11 o'clock news with sirens and fire, murder, all sorts of problems and crime, drugs. And there's been a tremendous change in these places. They've become vital places, bustling, healthy places, and very few people have noticed, except those usually who live right around there or who work in there, they notice. But the idea behind this book was to show that there'd been this enormous social movement that had transformed this. And it's a long story. It didn't start with one government program. That's what's unique about it. Mm-hmm. It started with a lot of people in their own neighborhoods who basically stood up and said, we're not going to take it anymore. Let's fight what is threatening our neighborhoods, which sometimes was government urban renewal programs. Let's stand up and fight and stop the blight and the destruction. And then as they started to do that, they began to figure out how you could rebuild. There wasn't a one-set formula.
Yeah. Something that struck me as very interesting is not only rebuilding, but preserving. Preservation is a big part of this story. Taking note of historic and architectural gems and preserving them. And this has been important in these renewal efforts that have been successful. And I think that maybe that says something a little bit about the problems of the past, is that we were interested in tearing down. That was the answer. And today,
that's right.
Today we have some things that are going to get torn down, but other things are going to be preserved.
I think so. I think the basic philosophy in the past was that you'd have a top-down policy. You'd have experts, whether they were in Washington or downtown in the city, people who knew what was best for their city. And because they didn't like what they saw, they couldn't appreciate the kind of life or the people, working class people who lived in certain areas, especially if they were close to downtown and looked like they might be good real estate development places. They were interested in tearing it down and building something new, usually something rather modernistic and cold. That became the modus operandi. And then when some of these places had problems with arson, the city became incredibly effective, much more effective in delivering than they were in delivering basic services, in demolishing any building that had been abandoned. So you have a sort of momentum of just taking things out. The people who lived in these places, though, appreciated what they had. They appreciated the older buildings, and some of them figured out that this actually was a tremendous asset. This is ironic because we were tearing down what was the best asset. But in many cases, the south side of Chicago, down in Atlanta, it was older buildings that attracted new people to those neighborhoods and became the kind of advertisement for these neighborhoods that changed the psychology into something positive, into something where you could defend the place and actually help it and start to rebuild.
Hmm. It seems to me that while sprawl, suburban sprawl, is continuing and is of great concern, we're again interested in living in cities. Would you share that impression? And if that's the case, what's at work here?
Well, you're absolutely right. There's been a tremendous turnaround. Those of us who can remember the 70s remember that a lot of people wouldn't go near not only the inner city neighborhoods, they wouldn't go downtown to the larger cities. The people who lived in the suburbs were terrified of it. There has been a movement or a kind of change in thinking about that, and I think that the community development movement, that's what we call this effort to improve neighborhoods, played a big role in this. And it starts with, I think, individuals, couples, families sometimes, who look around and don't buy the prevailing attitude towards these places. They find old Victorian houses or even bungalows that they think are worth saving. They see a vitality in the neighborhood that's worth preserving. And that's contributed to the big turnaround. Now, in some cities, there's sometimes a big event that helps turn it around. In Chicago, for those of you your listeners who know Chicago, the area just south of the Loop, the downtown, had been a great rail yards area, industrial, was next to the Skid Row, and just sat there kind of blocking progress. Beyond that, south of that, were was the largest stretch of public housing projects in the world. And together, those two blocked for a long time any progress. A number of people, and these were civic leaders, began to think about the the rail yards and began to develop what they called the South Loop, and create new neighborhoods there. At the same time, you had what are called pioneers, black pioneers, who moved into the South Side, into these neighborhoods, and started fixing up the houses. Those two things came together to create a kind of synergy and momentum of rebuilding the South Side. Finally, of course, there's a big climax to the story, as the mayor spearheads an effort to tear down the large public housing projects. But the what amazes me is that you found you're attracting first black people back into the city, and then whites going into these previously all-black neighborhoods, even before the public housing projects were torn down.
Hmm. And there's a number of issues here now that we can address here. We have the tear down of the high-rises in Chicago, which speaks to how rapidly change can happen. We also have the issue of race, and we also have an issue that causes a lot of concern in renewal efforts, and that is gentrification. Where should we begin with these three important issues?
It's a good question. They're all big and juicy, mm-hmm. and I'd like to run away from all of them because they're so complicated. But let's talk about race a little bit, because to me, one of the fascinating parts of the story is how people who live in what are called old ghetto neighborhoods in Chicago, the near South Side was called the Black Belt at one time, and these are historic neighborhoods, but they've been historically all black because they were born in the days of racial segregation and discrimination. So they're much more solidly African-American than other neighborhoods. At the same time, you had a kind of fear of these places from outsiders, and whites would flee and stay away. I'm fascinated because black activists have worked, often just ordinary people. I guess activist isn't even a good word, because they're often neighbors, might be a better word, just mm-hmm. people who live there, and who decide that they are tired of seeing their neighborhood go downhill. Or sometimes their new arrivals say, "Oh, well, this is really a great place. We've got to fix it up," and they begin to fix things up, and they do such a good job of it. And this will lead to the other topic, but they do such a good job of it that they change the whole image of the neighborhood. So the near West Side has really changed a lot as well. A place that was just in terrible shape till a man named Ernest Gates and began to organize, actually fix up his house and a couple houses nearby, and then built on that. Had a great struggle politically to get to make progress and get a hold of the stop urban renewal in his neighborhood. That worked. They got new housing with a sort of historic agreement with the Chicago Bulls and Blackhawks owners. And willy-nilly, whites began to filter in. And over there, they've decided they want to adopt a new name. They don't want to call it the Near West Side anymore. They want to call it West Haven. But I don't think they need to bother, because once the psychology, the attitudes, psychological attitudes about a neighborhood change, the name kind of changes too, the associations. Of course, that brings up the mm-hmm. problem of gentrification. Too much of a good thing. It's like too much ice cream.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to ask a question about gentrification.
Let's put gentrification aside, because I've got a listener waiting to talk with us on a cell phone. We're going to talk with the caller, and then we'll come back to gentrification, although who knows, this caller might have gentrification on his or her mind. Let's go to this listener on a cell phone on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Very interesting topic. I hope you can hear me all right on the cell phone.
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay. I'm actually a Chicago native, and the topic is right on target. Grew up on the South Side and moved about 30 years ago out of there. But I have noticed that the revitalization of the South Side, near South Side, and the West Side is primarily looks to be overtaken by people in their 20s and 30s, a lot of money, and obviously it's displacing a lot of poor people. And I just was curious as to your comment on that. But I have noticed as far as the urban scene, it's making quite a comeback. It's just, it concerns me because it seems like the middle class and the lower middle class people with families are being pushed aside for people with, cell phones and BMWs. I get a lot of that when I get back into the city. The neighborhood that I grew up with on the south side, actually southwest side, is still fairly decimated. The old churches and the convents and the rectories are gone, and I don't know if it's going to make a comeback anytime soon, but I have noticed the near part of the city making a fantastic comeback, and so I wanted to comment on that because I am from Chicago, and hopefully the renewed part of it can reach, hopefully, a little further out. I'll hang up and I'll listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, the caller covered a lot of topics, did bring up the problem of gentrification. It is, to me, amazing what has happened in Chicago. Just a little background, though, when we talk about this process, we should realize that long before the BMWs and cell phones showed up, long before real estate speculators showed up, these neighborhoods were bleeding people. The neighborhood of Oakland dropped to just a few thousand residents in the 1960s and 70s. You can go up and down the south side or the west side and see this. When you lose people, you lose capital, both of the social and the money type, and it becomes harder and harder to get services, to get attention, to get political attention from the powers that be. So it becomes increasingly desperate. When a place loses value, literally, when buildings become almost worthless, it is too expensive for landlords to keep them up. And sadly, they sometimes resort to arson just to get themselves out of the burden of paying taxes on properties. Whether they do it or someone else does it, you can see that these places are don't have value, and arson spread like a prairie fire across the South Side and parts of the West Side, and this is not unique to Chicago. The South Bronx is one of the scariest looking places. About 1980, where you could just see through those four or five story apartment buildings. You stand outside and you could look right through the windows, through the roof of the roofs of these buildings. So that's the background. When you're in a neighborhood like that, you'd be happy to have somebody with a BMW and a cell phone show up. It's a desperate situation. Now, as I say, once you get rolling and once you start rebuilding the neighborhood, that issue that the caller raised really comes to the fore. And Chicago in particular, although it's true in Boston and other places, San Francisco, has been wrestling with the problem of too much popularity in these older neighborhoods that are coming back. And you do wrestle with, can you have too much of a good thing? Well, it's very hard to control what happens. As an old Chicago friend of mine said when I was talking to him about these changes, hey, listen, neighborhoods, they either go down the drain or up the drain. It's hard to keep them at a steady level. But there are ways that you can protect people who live there. The city of Chicago, I believe, has tax abatement for property taxes for senior citizens who are in their houses but on fixed low incomes and might not be able to afford to make improvements. I know the Near West Side Community Development Group has a whole program where they just go in and they help fix up the old people's houses because they couldn't possibly afford to do it. You also have, or try to have, subsidized housing so that you protect people, renters, who might not be able to live there and make sure that they always have a place to stay in the old neighborhood. Mm.
I guess it's my feeling that a neighborhood that has a mix of, you know, a demographic mix is a stronger neighborhood than one that's just a solid block of whatever, no matter, you know. That's my opinion, but I'm wondering, you know, is
viable?
Yeah. Does it work?
I'm with you. And I think there are a lot of people who like that. You brought up sprawl and sort of the larger issue, which is the uncomfortable fact that a lot of Americans seem to think otherwise. They want to huddle in little homogenous areas where people just like themselves are there. And it's going to be hard to stop them. I will say that's one of the wonderful things about the revival of the city. And the caller mentioned the young people who are coming in. I'm impressed by a lot, I don't want to say all of them, but a lot of the young people who embrace city living also embrace the diversity. To them, it's part of the excitement of being near cultural places, being near music clubs or good restaurants or any of that. The idea that you have people of different races, people of different incomes, maybe even different ages, is something that they seem to accept and like. And I think that's great, and I hope that they and other people can continue to advertise how much fun living that way can be.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Alexander von Hoffman, author of House by House, Block by Block, The Rebirth of America's Urban Neighborhoods. We're talking this afternoon about the role local activists and community groups are playing in revitalizing city neighborhoods. Alexander von Hoffman is a senior research fellow at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard, and he teaches at Harvard's Graduate School of Design. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. I look forward to your questions and comments, listeners. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We've mentioned sprawl a couple of times here this afternoon, and I was wondering, as I was reading House by House, Block by Block, if planners and grassroots groups, if people in sprawling areas can learn from the experiences of city neighborhoods in terms of what works and what makes a space livable?
I think they can. You're talking about, I guess, the sort of physical arrangement of things. Mm-hmm. And certainly the group that's called the New Urbanists, this is a movement among designers, planners, and government officials. The former mayor of Milwaukee was very prominent in it. Push for the creation of new places that have the qualities of the old neighborhoods, that you can places where you can walk to the store, where you can look, where you actually walk down the street and can see your neighbors coming out of their houses and not just jump into your automobile and notice the make of their car as you drive off. There is something to be learned from old neighborhoods as far as planning goes. I also think that there's something to be learned as as our population shifts and moves around. The caller a little while ago mentioned that the neighborhoods further out in Chicago, and he might have even mentioned across the city line, neighboring towns, the older suburbs, mm-hmm. In Chicago and other cities, are experiencing some of the problems that the inner city neighborhoods experienced back in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Here is where the efforts of the community development movement really would should be applied. And one of my fears is that we're too slow to move from the successful places or places that are getting on their feet again in a pretty good way. We don't have to worry about them, to these other places that are receiving new working class and poor people and are beginning to have the problems that any community has if the residents don't have a lot of money to maintain properties the way well-to-do people do.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello. I've actually lived in Boston and Austin and San Francisco and lived in the very neighborhoods that are being gentrified. And one of the things that is a big issue is the balance of power politically in local communities between the poor who may live in already live in the gentrified neighborhood, those, i.e. developers and high-tech, whatever it may be, people with money move in and change that neighborhood. I mean, because before gentrification, the neighborhoods are already actually diverse and quite vibrant, et cetera. But the minute gentrification moves in, the very things that make those neighborhoods attractive can no longer be there any longer, whether families or businesses or et cetera. And, you know, one of the big issues is wages and jobs, in which the jobs that attract the wealthier people are usually not accessible to the people that are there initially. That's it. I'd like to curious what he had to say about it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, it's couple of things that go on. There are gentrification is a big word, and we use it fairly loosely to cover a lot of conditions. I knew a wonderful guy who was an activist in the South End neighborhood of Boston, which you might know about, and that was a place that for years was known as a kind of transient neighborhood. You had boarding houses, rumors that there was a large derelict population. There was also a large working class, sort of steady working class population, minorities, black and Puerto Rican people lived there. And it is now one of the most expensive neighborhoods in the city. An incredible transformation. So it's certainly gentrified. But this guy who was the active, he was an organizer, community organizer in the South End, and fought successfully against some of the gentry to get affordable housing for that neighborhood, to get more affordable housing, and good, wonderful projects. I wish you could see them because they're just beautiful designs, and they are the envy of anybody who lives there. But he said that the urban pioneers who came there in the 1960s and 1970s were wonderful because they had come there to pitch in and to help, and that's why they worked with their neighbors and to try to fight crime and do other good things to help the neighborhood. In the 1980s, you started to get the first wave of what people started to call yuppies, young urban professionals, and he said these people were wealthy, but they still enjoyed the neighborhood. They still had some of that spirit that they had come for urban living, they joined in neighborhood associations and they participated. Not all of them agreed with what his group was doing, but they shared that common bond, that interest in the neighborhood. Then, in the 1990s, you had people still wealthier. Yet, these were millionaires now, and their units cost easily $1 million. And he said that's where their problems began, because these people didn't care about the neighborhood one way or the other. They were so used to just buying whatever it is was that they needed in their life, that they figured they could buy a place in the neighborhood, and that's everybody just owed it to give them whatever services they wished. So there are different kinds of people out there in all under this gentrification rubric. On the matter of jobs, it is difficult to get the same kind of jobs for everybody. People have different skills, they have different interests, I think what we hope to get is a kind of diversity of jobs and wages for working class people, people who are working in hospitals and offices and running things, clerical workers, that are high enough that it can allow them to stay in the city. At the same time, you hope that there are units, whether they be apartments or houses, that these people can afford, and you hope that the government has programs either through mortgages or through rental assistance that will help to keep these people who are so important to the urban economy and to all of the national economy. Mm.
The caller used the words balance of power. And there's a story that you tell in House by House, Block by Block, that I think is really a fascinating one. We're back to Chicago here. Chicago's near West Side. This story involves Mayor Daley, Jerry Reinsdorf, Wilma Ward, and Ernest Gates, among many others. Now, we know the names Daley and Reinsdorf, and you've mentioned Ernest Gates earlier here in our conversation, but tell us about Wilma Ward and Ernest Gates and their allies and what it was that they succeeded in getting done on the Near West Side.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought it up because I love this story. Picture yourself in an old neighborhood. It's in decline. There's been fires. People aren't living there. Ernest Gates on the Near West Side, which is, for people who know Chicago, where the old basketball stadium, the Chicago Stadium, used to be. It's the neighborhood that's adjacent to that. And those of you who used to go to games there know that really the neighborhood around it declined more and more over the years. Ernest and his friend Wilma Ward, who works for community nonprofits in the area, were trying their level best to do what they could to help the neighborhood. And then the neighborhood faced an enormous threat. The Chicago Bears announced a plan to put their new football stadium in the middle of the neighborhood, not far from the Chicago Stadium. And it would have meant demolishing the old people's houses, or I should say the houses of the people who had lived there many years and were now elderly. And it started a long and very bitter battle where these little people, the Davids, against the Goliath of the football team, the owners of the Chicago Bears had been close to the Daley family, so it was really looked completely hopeless. It's a long struggle to stop this, and I won't go into all the details there. It's kind of fascinating, but the locals ended up going into the neighborhood of the owners of the football team distributing flyers saying, "Look, this is what they're trying to do to us. Would you want this to happen to your town?" And they were condemned in the newspapers as being total rabble rousers and no counts. Goes on and on, and finally they get a couple of breaks, and one of which is that Chicago's mayor, Richard M. Daley, decided that he was not going to intervene on behalf of the Bears, and so that they were going to have to negotiate with the neighbors, and then the other good break was that the owners began to alienate. There was a division between the Chicago Bulls and the Chicago Blackhawks owners, and the Chicago Bears, and they basically split and weakened their power Then what happens is the Chicago Bulls and the Blackhawks, the basketball and the hockey team, announce a plan, and they start to do the whole thing all over again. It is really difficult when you're a neighborhood person because there are always these threats of these big giants coming down and crushing you. And so they began to have a dispute with, they go to meetings. Jerry Reinsdorf and Howard Pizer, his longtime assistant, walked out of a meeting with the neighbors once, and the whole thing broke down. Went on for months and months, and finally the owners of the Bulls and the Blackhawks decided, well, they're going to try to negotiate. And it was a wonderful moment where Jerry Reinsdorf calls up Ernest Gates and he says, hey, I want to talk to you about your favorite subject, meaning the stadium and the renovations and all that, preservation of the neighborhood. And Gates says, what subject is that? Reinsdorf says, don't play stupid. and they start to talk, and then a most wonderful thing happens. They start to collaborate, and they become quite friendly. The sports teams say, we'll help you build new houses for the elderly residents. Well, there's a kind of interesting moment. Is that the neighbors were and the leaders were completely they were nervous about this. They were really anxious until they actually saw the houses. And then they said, let's throw a big celebration. And the mayor came and the owners of the team and all the residents, and they threw this big celebration. And Reinsdorf and Pizer were completely befuddled by this. They said, well, yeah, we built them, but we said we were going to build them. We signed an agreement several months ago. Well, we should have had the celebration then. And then it began to dawn on them that the neighbors had been betrayed so often that they lived with this kind of fear. And they began to understand what the residents had gone through. And it's like the end of Casablanca. It was the beginning of a beautiful friendship. They collaborate, and the Bulls and the Blackhawks put millions of dollars into that neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, so many agreements, it seems, are broken. They're essentially signed with disappearing ink. So it was really interesting to read that these people, they said, no, we're gonna put some safeguards in here. We want this to happen. And then there was no celebration until it really started to happen. Great story.
Yeah, I'm glad you like it. It was so interesting because the Bulls executives began to understand the people that they were dealing with in a way that they never had before as businessmen.
Yeah. Ernest Gates, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say there are a lot of these, I guess we could call them local heroes, that I have been so impressed with their courage. And I just wanted to say that you look at certain people, one of my favorites is a woman named Genevieve Brooks, who moved into the South Bronx when it was still a stable neighborhood and literally saw buildings all around her burn to the ground. Crime going on. It was just hopeless. And rather than moving out, as 99 out of 100 people had done, she stayed and fought. And for years, really, to be honest, got nowhere. It took a long time to get traction. And there are people like that in these neighborhoods, which I just find incredible.
Yeah. The tenacity is amazing. And also, the ability of people to come together and build a support system, to build alliances. What's key here in terms of building a support system, building an alliance? What's key to their success?
Well, there's a couple of things. They have to be savvy people. They have to be savvy organizers. They have to be able to get along with all different kinds of folks. They have to be able to size up what's really in the neighborhood. Often these neighborhoods actually have more going for them than you'd first imagine, and you find that there are service agencies, there are sometimes there are even companies around, maybe a university, a hospital, which could threaten the neighborhood, but could also be a really powerful ally. So you have to be able to do business, so to speak, with a large number of people. That's a really important part in making the alliance. And you have to be able to use what's going on. And quite honestly, a threat to the neighborhood is this isn't true not only in working class neighborhoods, it's true in every neighborhood. A threat will bring people out to defend their turf. And that is in the case of we just talked about, and a lot of other cases in Los Angeles, one neighborhood they were going to put in a huge waste disposal facility that was going to pollute the area, the air around there, and bring these large, dangerous trucks plowing through it at all hours of the day. Those kinds of things bring people out. So you have some of that can help in trying to organize people. The other thing that you need to do when you're rebuilding or the people is to show some progress. And I think that's why a lot of these groups, they're called community development corporations, get involved in restoring an apartment building, building some new homes, maybe even building some multifamily structures, and show that these places can be showcases. They can be valuable homes for people, and that they're not going to deteriorate. They are going to be places that show that the neighborhood can function. So a demonstration of what you can do is often an important first step. Mm.
Last night, Vice President Cheney and Democratic vice presidential nominee Edwards met in debate in Cleveland. And prior to their debate, the mayor was quoted as saying that he hoped the two would talk about cities like Cleveland and the problems Cleveland faces, including having a very high rate of poverty, I think the highest in the nation. In the end, though, last night, domestic issues didn't receive a lot of time. Does the federal government have a role to play in urban renewal, and could it assist a city like Cleveland?
The federal government has a very large role, and it is playing it already in some ways. It could do an awful lot more, but the system that we have is decentralized, the new system. In the old days, as I said, with the urban renewal program, you had money came out of Washington and it went downtown more or less. So the mayor and the downtown businessmen and people like that would basically make the plan. And the plan usually meant, as we said, demolition. It didn't augur well for the locals. That kind of top-down planning really failed. In fact, even large-scale projects where even since then where someone comes in and says, I've got a lot of money and a great plan and we're going to just transform the whole place all in one fell swoop, those usually fail because you need people on the ground, in the neighborhood, on the street, people who know what will work in their little neck of the woods. That said, you also need money and programs. So the federal government has a number of programs by which it sends money into places such as Cleveland. And it really depends then again on how they're used locally. But you have the Community Development Block Grant Program, which goes from the federal government to the state and often to the city, and then they decide how to disperse it. Well, you hope that you have some good nonprofits on the ground who will, and some enlightened political leaders who will send that money to these community development groups and start to develop it. A lot of money comes in that way. There are housing programs, which are very important, a number of them. The Section 8 program, which is a subsidy program, And how that works out in an actual building or in a place really depends on the people and the competence of the people who are doing it. But Section 8 is a tremendous help to low-income people who are going to have a lot of trouble paying their rent if they didn't receive those kinds of subsidies. And then another assistance to community development groups is something called the Low Income Housing Tax Credit. And this is a tax credit that for groups, entities that build low-income housing. A lot of the groups that I've looked at are nonprofits, so they can't use a tax credit because they don't pay taxes of that sort anyway. So what they do is they sell the tax credit to corporations, to private groups, who then put that money into the low-income housing projects. So the government has a lot of ways of helping, and it is essential that the federal government be committed to this and not try to squeeze these programs, such as the Section 8, which the current administration has had sent out a couple of balloons, trial balloons, as to ways that they might shrink that program, through the other programs that that help the people in the local neighborhood and good city administrators and political leaders.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. And, of course, there's a role to play by state governments and institutions like banks and universities and hospitals, and that's all here also in House by House, Block by Block. Alexander von Hoffman, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed it, and it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed reading this book. It's a very readable, great stories. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Alexander von Hoffman, our guest this afternoon in this portion of the afternoon magazine, author of House by House, Block by Block, The Rebirth of America's Urban Neighborhoods. He joined us this afternoon from Harvard University. And our thanks this afternoon to the folks at Harvard for help with this high-quality phone line that we used this afternoon. It's 7 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, the bean and the corn futures both finished the day higher, but probably not much to be read into that, as it was reported most of that was short covering as the speculators decided to hop out of the market, take some profits on the ideas that the downside in the market had given them enough, and that they wanted to be on the sidelines prior to next Tuesday's crop production report. Of course, we'll have a complete look at that next Tuesday morning during the pre-opening and the opening market report. Crop production numbers due out along with the WASDE numbers, that's the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates from USDA next Tuesday morning. Be sure to tune in for that with Dave Dickey this afternoon. Now let's take a look at the numbers as they came across from the Board of Trade at the end of the day trade. December wheat futures are 307 and a half high today, a low at 301. They settled 302. The wheat was down today 4.5 cents in that December contract. The March was off 4.5 as well. Actually, the December was down 4.25. The March was off 4.5. It had a high of 319, a low of 312.75, and a settlement price there in the March contract 314. May futures in the wheat pit 324.5, the high, the low at 319, settled 319.5. They were off 4.5 for the day. And the July contract, a 329.25 high, low at 323.5, settled at 324, down 3.25 on the day. From the corn pit, the nearby December contract, a high today of 209, low at 203.25. Settlement price up near the high, 207.25, 2.75 higher for the end of the day. March futures on this Wednesday afternoon, 219, the high, the low at 214, settled 218, they were up 3. And the May contract at 225.75 high, low at 221.25, settlement price at 224.75, up 2.5 cents. July futures in the corn pit, 232.25, the high, the low at 227.25, settled at 231.5, they were up 2.5 cents. And September futures, 238.75, the high, the low at 234.5, settled at 237.5, 2.5 cents higher. December futures, 245.25, the high, the low at 242. Settled 245, up 1.75. DSOATs, 145, the high, the low at 140, settled 144.75, up 1.75. And the March oats, 151 three quarters the high, the low at 147 and one half. And their settlement price for the day at 151 and one half, they finished the day a penny higher. From the soy complex, the nearby beans, 533 and a half the high for the November, 521 and a half the low. Settlement price for the no beans, 526 and a quarter. They were up 2 1/4 at the end of the day. January, 541 high, low at 529. Settlement price at 534, up 1 1/2. And the March contract, up 1 3/4 for the day, with the settlement price at 541, a high at 548 and a low at 537 for the March. The May futures, 554 high, low at 543 and a half, settled 547 and 3/4, up 1 1/4. And July futures, 560 the high, the low at 549 and a half. Settlement price there at 554 and a quarter, up 1 3/4. Bean meal, the October contract, 155.20 the high, the low at 152.30. Settlement price up 90 cents. December at 158.80 on the high, the low at 155.80. Settlement price at 156.70, and they were up 40. October oil, 21.40 the high, the low at 21, settled 21, down a nickel. And December futures at 21.57 for the high, the low at 21.05, settled 7 cents lower at 21.09. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, we had a higher day today for live cattle and lean hogs, as well as February bellies. And feeder cattle, they finished mixed. 2 out of 3 contracts that we keep track of finished lower today. October feeder cattle, 113.50 the high, 112.62 and a half the low, 113.10 the settlement, that down 12 and a half. November, 112.25 the high, 111.40 the low, 111.82 and a half the settlement, that up 7 and a half. January, 108.75 the high, 107.95 the low, 108.25 the settlement, that down 10 cents. October live cattle, 86.75 the high, 86.10 the low, 86.22 and a half the settlement, that up a nickel. December live cattle, 89.20 the high, 88.55 the low, 88.87 and a half the settlement, that up 5 cents. October lean hog, 74.10 the high, 72.80 the low, 73.90 the settlement, that up 127 and a half. December 67.10 the high, 65.85 the low, 66.80 the settlement, that up 105. February lean hog, 65.85 the high, 65.05 the low, 65.55 the settlement today, that up 47 and a half. April, 63.45 the high, 62.60 the low, finishing at 63.32 and a half, that up 57 and a half. February bellies, 98.40 the high, 96.50 the low, 97.97 and a half the settlement, that up 137 and a half. The Dow up 5 points at 10,183. The NASDAQ down 1 at 1954. The S&P 500 up 1 at 1136.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Rafael Garcia from Chula Vista, California wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, why do they lock gas station bathrooms? I live in California, and after long hours at the freeway, I often need to use those bathrooms.
They're afraid somebody will clean them. Next thing you know, somebody might be living in one, and after 60 days, that person could claim homesteading rights. Stranger things have happened in the state that turned the personal injury lawsuit into a license to print money. If I'm ever in California, I make sure